Welcome to Guide to the Cosmos on WebTalkRadio.net with your host, Dr. Robert Piccioni, physicist, public speaker, and author of Everyone's Guide to Atoms, Einstein, and the Universe, and his new second book, Can Life Be Merely an Accident? With Robert as our guide to the cosmos, we will explore the frontiers of science and participate in the exciting discoveries of physics, astronomy, and cosmology. Now, providing public access to science, here's your host, Dr. Robert Piccioni.
Thank you for joining us, and welcome back. We have a great show for you today, and we also have a great limited-time free offer for our radio listeners. So go to guidetothecosmos.com and click on the word free, and we'll send you a spectacular album of celestial images complete with descriptions. This is something that you'll enjoy sharing with your family and friends as you explore the cosmos. So hurry and go to guidetothecosmos.com and click on the word free. We can all remember free, can't we? Today we will discuss cold fusion and whether or not the scientists that appeared on 60 Minutes lied about cold fusion to suit their own personal agendas. Today we have a special guest, Stephen Krivet, who is the editor and publisher of the online magazine New Energy Times. And Steve is going to talk to us today about cold fusion and LENAR, a new approach to generating energy. Since the year 2000, as an investigative scientific reporter, Steve has been reporting on low-energy nuclear research, which has historically been called cold fusion. He is the author of several chapters in a book called Cold Fusion History and LENAR Research. This is published in the 2009 Elsevier Encyclopedia of Electrochemical Power Sources. He is also the co-author of two American Chemical Society LENAR source books and the senior editor of a forthcoming publication by John Wiley and Sons called The Encyclopedia of Nuclear Energy. Steve speaks frequently on international forums to scientific as well as general public audiences. So, Steve, I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Robert. It's a pleasure to speak with you.
Well, Steve, tell us a little bit about your background first. You're deeply involved in this really advanced frontier of science, but as I understand it, you're not exactly a scientist yourself. How did you manage to make that connection?
That's correct, Robert. I've been following the subject for 10 years. Before that, I had a career in information technology. I have had two college courses in physics, but my academic background is in business and computers and also industrial design. It's a little unclear as to how I got so interested 10 years ago in this subject, but I guess it's an interesting subject for many people's perspective. I just followed one connection and talked to one person and talked to another person, and eventually, by 2003, I ended up speaking with and meeting with quite a few of the scientists and researchers in the field. They became my teachers. After many years, I have been basically in class, effectively, when I've been learning about this research.
So you learned sort of on the job, as it were.
On the job, in the trenches.
The job, in the trenches, right, from the University of the School of Hard Knocks.
Yes, you can say that.
Okay. So what did you learn?
What I learned was that most of the people who were doing research in this field were serious scientists. They had PhDs. They worked for credible institutions. They weren't just garage tinkerers. I mean, with all due credit to garage tinkerers, sometimes you get wonderful things coming out of garages.
But yeah, I was in Steve Jobs' garage when he showed me one of his first computers. Yeah,
there you go.
I think he made good.
I think so too. So, you know, I met over 100 of these people in 2003 in August, and I just realized, okay, there's something here. And there's something else that I learned from the beginning, that there was a broad, diverse set of experimental research that had been repeated around the world, various independent groups, for at that time, that was 13, 14 years. And it occurred to me, well, how could this be all the result of something that was all a mistake or all collusion? The probabilities of that, to me, seem to reach close to zero.
Okay. So maybe we should step back for a second, Steve, and we sort of plunge right into the meat of the subject, but maybe we should give a little bit of background about cold fusion. Fundamentally, this is an effort to generate fabulous amounts of energy without the enormous temperatures that we associate with normal nuclear reactions, like nuclear fission in power plants and even atomic bombs or even nuclear fusion in stars.
Yes, and in fact, we will eventually get to this distinction, but I want to put it out there right now. Mm-hmm. I don't even call it cold fusion anymore. I just want to get that clear from the beginning. I'm calling this field and the research low-energy nuclear reactions. But let's work on that distinction a little bit later.
Right, okay.
But if you'll just permit me to call it Leonard for the time being.
Mm-hmm.
Two gentlemen, Martin Fleischmann and Stanley Pons, announced in a press conference on March 23rd, 1989, that they had figured out a way to create fusion in a very relatively simple desktop room temperature experiment. And this had been something that many people around the world had been, not this particular method, but the concept of fusion had been something that people, researchers, had been trying to do for many decades around the world, to be able to create an experiment which produced more energy out than you had to put in. This was a first. It was considered to be the achievement of the equivalent of the Holy Grail of energy. And it was, of course, received with a great amount of skepticism. But what Fleischmann and Pons did find, and what has sustained throughout the 21 years, is that there is an effect that does produce nuclear-scale energy. Now, there's still a great debate as to what nuclear process is responsible, but that the fact that the energy being created is of a nuclear scale and that it is more energy is being produced than is being put into the experimental cell, there is, it's not a commercially viable system yet, but there are strong indicators. In fact, every indicator that is known about the experiments thus far suggests that if it can be fully understood and fully developed from an engineering perspective, it very much has the possibility to being the foundation for a new energy source. And as you mentioned, it does not have the harmful side effects and byproducts of the other two forms of well-known nuclear energy, both fission and fusion, as it is shown in experimental research.
Mm-hmm. So the reason that our listeners should care about this is that nuclear energy processes can be millions of times more efficient in generating energy than chemical processes. So when you say nuclear scale energy, you're talking about a phenomenally more efficient way of generating energy, which, if we could ultimately bring it to society, would solve an immense number of problems, including pollution and energy costs. And in fact, it would have an enormous impact on geopolitics, wouldn't it?
If you take a certain amount of hydrogen and you burn it, you're going to get a certain amount of energy. If you are able to take that same amount of hydrogen and release the energy from it in a nuclear fashion, a nuclear reaction, you're going to get millions of times more energy out of the same amount of hydrogen. So that's the distinction that you just mentioned in terms of the benefit of being able to have a nuclear reaction from a raw material versus a chemical reaction.
Okay, well, this sounds like the Holy Grail, as you described. So there was evidence for nuclear, for what was then called cold fusion, as early as 1989. And you say that there is continuing evidence from many different sources, and you mentioned that there were in excess of 100 scientists at this conference you attended. So it's a relatively rich group of researchers working on this subject. And how much progress have they made, and why have things made such a dramatic turn recently?
There is very strong evidence for this phenomena as a nuclear process, as a new kind of nuclear process from the very early days. Even from 1989, there was evidence of tritium. Now, you cannot make tritium at levels significantly above background from anything but a nuclear reaction. So the evidence for this as a real nuclear effect was available from basically day one, or from not day one, from year one, the evidence was there. Why don't we all know about this? Why hasn't it developed into a more accepted form of science research? Why hasn't it gone forward into a more commercially developed? Well, the big story, as you probably know, we are dealing with one of the most controversial science discoveries of the last 100 years. Now, so the evidence was there. Now, what has happened in terms of the development of that evidence to make it stronger, broader, clearer in the last 21 years? There have been numerous aspects of the research. We're talking about low fluxes of neutrons, energetic alphas, transmutations, isotopic shifts, a whole smorgasbord of nuclear effects and products that have been observed. So it's really, in my mind, it's unequivocal that this is a nuclear reaction generating energy. Now, the question is, if the research is so solid, then you're probably going to wonder, well, how come we're not using it now, or why is it still a controversy? Is that probably the next logical question?
Absolutely.
Okay. All right.
Well, I think everybody that's listening is asking the same question. Why am I paying $3 a gallon for gasoline or more?
Okay. Good.
If this
then
stuff
I'm on
works.
Track here.
Yeah, go.
Okay. We're going to have to take a look at it from a science sociology perspective to answer those questions. One of the privileges I have had in 10 years of following this investigation is speaking with and meeting quite a few of the people who were very antagonistic against this from the very beginning. Bob Park, who was the former spokesperson of the American Physical Society, Stephen Koonin, and Nathan Lewis, who were at Caltech, who were quite outspoken and not in a favorable way against Fleischmann and Pons, and quite a few of the others. And one of the things I've learned from speaking to these people is I have learned where the real criticisms of the field are and where there aren't real criticisms. I've learned a lot about scientific skepticism and pathological skepticism. There's been a lot of unscientific discussions about the subject for 21 years. There's been a lot of uninformed discussion about it. And I would say in the last 10 years, and more specifically in the last 5 years, a lot of the unscientific representations and discussions have actually come from people within the Lenner field. Now, that must surprise you.
Well, it would surprise me if people were rational, but as we all know, they're very often not rational. We do all kinds of crazy things as human beings that no sane person would do, so why should scientists be different?
What has become clear, at least to me, is that in the last few years, is that this phenomenon really is not explained by the concept, by the hypothesis of a cold fusion process. It has been the push to media, to government, by certain people within the Lehner field to continue promoting this as a fusion process, which seems to be the most counterproductive effect to establishing credibility for the field and to advance its progress.
Why would they be doing that?
I wish I had the answer for you, and that is a mystery I hope to solve. All I can say is that I've observed what appears to be, well, you mentioned the word irrational. To me, I have observed behavior that appears dogmatic and almost religious in a way. It's very difficult to explain, and I have attempted as best as I am possible to try to follow their arguments scientifically, but inevitably the people who continue to insist, who know about the contradictions of it being explained as fusion, even though they know about it, their insistence on it as a process that's explained by fusion, the basis for their explanations seem to just get weaker and weaker over the last 5 years. That's what I see going on.
You are listening to WebTalkRadio.net. I am your host, Robert Piccioni, and we are talking today with Steve Krivet, the editor of the New Energy Times, about cold fusion, truth or lies. We'll be right back after these messages. When you're planning a cruise, the best place for comparing prices and itineraries is CruiseDirect.com. You can choose your cruise by destination, cruise line, or budget. CruiseDirect.com is your online destination for cruising.
Explore Dr. Piccioni's website, GuideToTheCosmos.com, and check out the spectacular discounts that are available to you, our radio audience. Robert's first book, Everyone's Guide to Atoms, Einstein, and the Universe, makes the exciting discoveries of modern physics, astronomy, and cosmology understandable for everyone. And it was just selected as the best science book of the year by National Best Books. As Robert says, you don't have to be a great musician to appreciate great music, and the same is true for science. If you can change money, you can understand Einstein. Robert's second book, Can Life Be Merely an Accident?, describes how precisely tuned the universe is to support life, and shows how amazingly improbable that is. Go to Robert's website and send us your questions, comments, and suggestions for future shows. That's GuideToTheCosmos.com.
We're back, talking with Steve Krivet, editor of the New Energy Times, about whether the scientists that appeared on 60 Minutes and talked about cold fusion lied about their results. Now, Steve, in a recent issue of your magazine, the New Energy Times, which incidentally our listeners can get access to that through your website, newenergytimes.com, in this recent issue, you went even further than what you just said, and it seemed to me that you indicated that there had been some deliberate misrepresentation of data by some of these scientists.
Yes.
So this is beyond some sort of irrational belief that they are fighting for. This is, in fact, scientific fraud.
No, I'm not going to say scientific fraud, although people are free to make their own assessments of that. I've thought about this quite a bit, and for it to be fraud, and mind you, I've spent quite a bit of time investigating alleged science fraud. I have investigated the allegations of Fleischmann Pons that originally that some people alleged that they had done fraud. I've done an investigation with Rusi Taliarkin, Seth Putterman. There's been a couple of other fraud allegations or potential fraud investigations I've looked into quite. I'm very familiar with the subject matter.
Mm-hmm.
Fraud requires intent. It requires intent to deceive.
Mm-hmm.
As far as the misrepresentation of data that's unsupported, in this case, I do not know if the lead person on that team had the intent to deceive. I don't know that. What I do know, to the best of my ability, is that two numbers were changed in the opposite directions without a scientific basis. One number was invented, again, without a scientific basis. Now, if it's not fraud, what else could it be? Well, perhaps the person believed so much in a certain hypothesis that somehow they rationalized in their mind these unscientific changes. That's my perspective of the situation.
Okay.
You can call it fraud if you want, but I want to be careful on that.
Okay, so you say two numbers were altered, two data points were altered, and a third one was added without any scientific justification to a publication which purported to support this concept of cold fusion.
Yeah, in fact, it wasn't just a publication. The first report of this was in 2000 at a cold fusion conference, and that was published in the proceedings. But the more critical one was that this information was submitted to the Department of Energy as part of what was supposed to be a review of the field, and it was submitted to their 2004 review, and it was presented as the most precise experiment which showed evidence of quote-unquote cold fusion. So that's where this becomes a bit of a problem.
Yeah, and these publications aren't just for scientific curiosity. These are publications that justify continuing investment by the United States government of major sums of money in the research of these people who, let's say, have accidentally or deliberately misrepresented their results.
Well, I don't know if to what extent there's any continuing funding in that direction for those people at the moment.
Oh, do you think the government has caught on to this and has cut them off?
DARPA had been funding the group involved. I don't know if that's... I haven't heard of any continuing DARPA-supported work since in the last few years.
Okay. Okay, so there was a group, and if my understanding is correct, this group represented either the majority or the most important portion of the research that was going on in the field that was previously called cold fusion. And the misrepresentation of data that you talk about came from that one of those leading groups. Is that a fair statement?
Yes and no. It didn't represent the majority. And it's not your fault for, you know, thinking that, because it what it represented was the most vocal and outspoken groups in the field, particularly in the United States. Cold fusion, historically, in 1989, was largely dominated by several outspoken people who were critical against it. And what's happened in the last 10 years is within the field of LENR, as I now call it, it continues to have a small group of people that seem to have gained control over a lot of the character of the field. They've gained control over many of the conferences, of the agendas, who gets to speak. So it's important to distinguish between the them as representing the majority of the researchers in the Leonard field versus these few who have gained political control and domination of the field. Does that make sense?
Well, that makes sense, and I guess it must be surprising to many of our listeners to realize that within science that there is this degree of politics where one group can prevent another group from presenting papers at scientific conferences, can prevent another group from gaining access to major funding sources, can prevent other people from, for instance, getting advancement in university positions, and really motivated not by science necessarily, but by, you know, personal jealousies and politics, which we normally don't associate with science.
Robert, it's even more disturbing than that. These are people who, many of us, myself included, have put high on a pedestal as being virtuous scientists who have stood for truth in the light of being the underdogs, of disgraced by quote-unquote mainstream science, by being treated unfairly by mainstream science. And many of us at various times have thought that, well, these people that are in the Leonard field, they're different from the Robert Parks and the other people who have demonized Leonard research. Well, they're, you know, to a certain extent, they have had the open-mindedness to consider this novel area of research. But when the money comes down to the table, when the papers come to them for peer review in the journals, when the decisions come to them to decide who gets an oral presentation and who gets sent out to the poster room, they have made very clear political decisions as to who their favorites are going to be and who they're going to allow to advance within that community, as they like to call it.
Mm-hmm. In the last 6 months or so, there was a major story that was aired on 60 Minutes on television. And some of these people that you're talking about were prominent in that show. And if you believed what was said on 60 Minutes, all of this exciting energy research was the result of cold fusion, was the result of deuterium atoms fusing together to make helium. There was a very expensively produced video that was shown from an Israeli company where deuterium atoms were bouncing around jovially forming helium. And wouldn't you say that 100% of that was nonsense? I'm not saying that there isn't a nuclear process going on. The allegation that all of this is due to cold fusion, that's what's nonsense.
You know, that gets into the heart of the distinction between cold fusion and Leonard. We're going to have a discussion about mass energy balance to really do that subject justice. But there were some real problems with that 60 Minutes show.
I mean, did you see that film I'm talking about where they had the deuterium atoms bouncing together and helium coming out?
Oh, yes. Now I know what you're talking
about.
That
was the Israeli company?
That was the former Israeli company.
You said former company. Is that because they're out of business or were they purchased by some other company?
I was told that last December they had lost their funding, closed their doors, and that we're talking about energetics technologies, and I didn't get a confirmation on that until just recently when I learned that the researchers from energetics were now moving over to the University of Missouri. So here's the problem with the energetics situation. I mean, from a scientific perspective, I mean, there's other problems, but from a scientific perspective, they promoted their results as having 25 times more energy out than in. But they had one experiment that showed this. They had a second experiment that resulted in 16 times But this happened back in, I think it was 2004.
Mm-hmm.
They were never able to replicate it.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, going on national television and saying, and going on the World Wide Web and saying, you have an energy, a technology that produces 25 times more energy out than in, based on a single unrepeated experiment, you know, that is just really sketchy.
Mm-hmm. Well, most scientists spend more on research than they do on making beautiful promotional films.
And that's the opposite of what happened with the energetics. They spent more on their marketing and their promotion. They certainly seem to have a very friendly relationship with the 60 Minutes people. They spent a lot of money on the Cold Fusion conference that happened in Washington, D.C. They spent a lot of money on the next conference promoting that and supporting it. So, yeah, heavy on the marketing, light on the science. You know, it does not, it's not a real workable formula for progress.
Right. You wrote a book proclaiming that the Cold Fusion was a reality. And what year was that book published in, and what was the title?
The Rebirth of Cold Fusion: Real Science, Real Energy, Real Hope. How about that?
Oh, that's a great title.
We're talking end of 2004, beginning of December 2004, January 2005. And, yeah, I know where you're going. You're saying, well, I just published something that basically I said that I don't believe that cold fusion is real anymore, right?
That was my next question.
You
know, and it takes a really special person to stand up and make a big change like that. So tell us why you changed your mind, what you now think.
Thank you, Robert. I appreciate that. Yeah, and it did occur with some consternation on my part. And this, again, we're not, there's no question about it being nuclear. There's no question about it being a very energetic process. There's no question about it being something that still has the same hope and potential as a clean energy source. What happened for me was, I think it was about 2005, 2006, I started learning about a different idea in terms of how this can be explained. And simply, it has to do with a neutron capture process, an electroweak process, which is not a fusion process, the joining of two like-charged atomic nuclei, which overcome the Coulomb barrier. It was David Nagel, who is with the George Washington University. Nagel came to me and said, Steve, you really should look at this theory, this Widom-Larson theory. This is Alan Widom and Lewis Larson. And I said, look, Dave, I haven't heard anybody say anything good about any quote-unquote cold fusion theory except the people who come up with them. And nobody has any consensus at all about any theories. And so, look, I don't really want to waste my time until there's a minimal level of coherence or endorsement support of a theory. I blew Nagel off for a couple months, and then I started hearing chatter about this. I think it was from Italy. I started hearing people talk about it, and that was unprecedented, because I had never heard of anybody, again, except for these theorists, they're talking about their own theories. I had never heard anybody speaking even moderately favorably about another theory. So I started paying a little attention to it, and then Nagel gave me a one-hour tutorial on it, and I learned some basics of it. And my mind was open to it, although it was a little disturbing, because I obviously had spent thousands of dollars and put a lot of time into and a lot of my ego and, I guess, what little reputation I had at the time of promoting this fusion idea. Well, Nagel says to me, it's not fusion based on this. And I go, well, I don't know. Well, I'll look at it. And I started looking at it. And it started making a little bit more sense. I looked at it more. It started to make a lot more sense. I mean, here's the beauty of it. If it's correct, and I don't know if it's correct, or if there are other theories that are like it that are based on neutron capture processes, the beauty is that you don't have to figure out some miracle of how the Coulomb barrier is being overcome, and you don't have to invent new physics with imaginary particles or imaginary processes. It can be explained by conventional physics, but tied together in a novel way that nobody else apparently has seen this way to tie it together. Larson saw it. That's what Larson saw. Then he pulled in Alan Whittem and later Yogi Srivastava, and they developed a mathematically viable and potentially scientifically viable theory.
We have had on our radio show before Lewis Larson, who did tell us something about this, but we want to hear more about this from you directly, Steve. Unfortunately, today we're out of time, so we've covered the issue of why cold fusion, in its historical name, should be laid to rest. And next time we get together, we'll find out about this new technology, this new theory that has so much greater promise to make a tremendous contribution to both our energy crisis and also to the concerns of polluting our planet and global warming. So, Steve, I want to thank you very much for joining us today, and I look forward to following up on what LENAR is really about and what it can do for us.
Thank you, Robert. It's been a pleasure to speak with you today.
Thank you, Steve. Thank you for tuning in today. And remember, you are never too young or too old to wonder why.
Don't forget to explore Robert's website, guidetothecosmos.com, and check out the spectacular discounts on his books that are available to you, our radio audience. Send us your questions, comments, and suggestions for future show topics. That's guidetothecosmos.com. Goodbye.